From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we start the hour in Wisconsin, where lawmakers could vote today on a Republican plan to strip power from the state's incoming Democratic administration. The changes would limit the governor-elect's ability to write state rules or adjust public benefits programs and make it more difficult for the incoming attorney general to pull Wisconsin out of a lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act. Joining us now for more is Patrick Marley, state politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, what exactly are the changes that Republicans are proposing there in Wisconsin?
They're pretty sweeping. They would put some limits on early voting, restrict that to 2 weeks. Right now it's available for as much as 6 weeks. They would curb the powers of the incoming Democratic governor. They would greatly curtail the powers of the incoming attorney general, who's also a Democrat. And they would give the legislature more control of the state job creation agency. There are a lot of elements to this bill, but that's sort of the headline elements of them.
And many are looking at this and saying this is just sour grapes. They're upset that they lost the governorship and the attorney general's office.
That is what the Democrats opposed to this are saying, exactly.
So the governor-elect, Tony Evers, says he's going to take any steps possible to stop this from happening. Is there anything that he can do?
Well, there's some questions about that. I think he's waiting to see exactly what ends up passing. There's talk of litigation. I think we're likely to see that. But in the meantime, all that Tony Evers can do is try to use the bully pulpit to try to persuade Republicans not to do this. So far, it does not appear to be working.
And the outgoing governor, Scott Walker, would have to sign these changes into law. What's he saying about this?
He said that he thinks these are all pretty modest proposals. He thinks that he's just locking in the kinds of policies he's put in place over the last 8 years and largely was supportive of these ideas.
And the Senate Majority Leader there in Wisconsin, Scott Fitzgerald, who's a Republican, has called some of the reaction to this plan manufactured outrage by the Democrats. What is the case that Republicans are making about why these changes are necessary now during a lame duck session when there's so much opposition?
Yeah, that's interesting. Scott Fitzgerald called this inside baseball. He says he doesn't understand why people are upset by it. The message from legislative leaders is that the governor and the legislature need to be on the same playing field, that they were able to work with Governor Walker because they were of the same party, and now that it's going to change, they want to have more say in the running of state government.
So there have been some big protests there at the state capitol, over 1,000 people. What has the scene been like there?
You know, we had these massive protests in 2011 when Governor Walker was first elected. So these were good-sized protests that they had yesterday, but nothing in the order of what we saw in 2011. It seems that Democrats, to some extent, are trying to present themselves in a way where they're making spirited but polite arguments against this, in part in an effort to portray the Republicans as engaging in a power grab. And they have had some success. One proposal that was on the table would have moved Wisconsin's presidential primary in 2020 from April to March. That was designed to prevent the primary from happening on the same day as a state Supreme Court election. Republicans were worried that the presidential primary would have very high Democratic turnout and that a conservative would lose the Supreme Court race. So they were going to move the primary, which would have created an extra election at a cost of about $7 million to taxpayers. So there's a big lobbying effort to stop that, and that appears to have been dropped. Last night, the budget committee didn't take up that legislation.
So what's your expectation as we look forward to the rest of today about whether this is going to pass?
Yeah, I think it's very likely that it will pass. It's certainly in the state assembly, which has a very large Republican majority. It could easily pass. In the state Senate, the margin is a lot closer. The Republicans cannot afford more than one defection. But it does appear that Republicans are more likely than not to pass this package at this point.
Patrick, Wisconsin is not the only state where Republicans have been accused of trying to rewrite the rules on their way out. A similar fight is happening in Michigan right now. Democrats accused Republican legislators in North Carolina of what they call the legislative coup in 2016. Is there a sense in Wisconsin that this is part of a broader strategy by Republicans after a bruising loss in the midterms?
Yes, that's definitely a concern that Democrats are raising, that they're saying that they see this as a pattern, that it's happening in other states, that they're calling Republicans sore losers and trying to cling to power. And I think there's a concern, in particular, if you look at a state like North Carolina, where they also had maps that were drawn heavily to favor Republicans, and a lot of bitter feelings among Democrats about how they feel they've been shut out of legislative races. That's very similar in Wisconsin, the feelings among Democrats. So they're definitely drawing parallels to those other states.
That is Patrick Marley, who is state politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We'll be watching what happens today in Wisconsin. Patrick, thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, a court filing from special counsel Robert Mueller is set to be released before midnight, and it's expected to tell us more about President Trump's former national security advisor Michael Flynn's cooperation with the investigation. Remember, a year ago, Flynn pled guilty to lying to investigators about his communications with then-Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak about easing Russian sanctions. Well, how does that connect, if it does, with recent revelations in the Mueller investigation? Let's check in with Phil Ewing, NPR National Security Editor. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Robin.
So to remind us, Michael Flynn was in the White House for about a month, forced to resign after he was said to also mislead Vice President Mike Pence about his contact with Russians. So do you think the investigation is drawing lines from Flynn's lies to Trump lawyer Michael Cohen now saying he also lied about talks with Russia and building a Trump Tower? One Flynn talking about easing sanctions against Russia, another Cohen trying to make a deal with Russia.
Well, we're going to be looking at these documents very carefully today, if in fact all of their contents are public, to try and connect those storylines together, if in fact they do connect, because we don't know what the special counsel's office is going to say. What we expect this material to be is an account by prosecutors of the cooperation that Flynn has given the government since that guilty plea you mentioned, the things that he's told them, the help that has given investigators and prosecutors in doing other aspects of the Russia investigation. And then the special counsel's office may also say to a judge, "Dear judge, in light of Mr. Flynn's cooperation, we would like you to sentence him accordingly. And given the potential consequences he could be facing, go on the lighter side or go on the heavier side." In other instances in the Russia investigation, the special counsel's office has complained in its filings about the cooperation it's gotten from witnesses, and it is asked for more aggressive sentencing. Because this document isn't out yet, we don't know exactly right what position the government will take.
Well, we should say the Trump Tower deal never went through. But what about BuzzFeed's reporting? They say a named source is telling them that the Trump Organization was planning to offer a $50 million penthouse in that Trump Tower at Moscow to Russian President Putin, ostensibly as a way to get Russian oligarchs to buy their own apartments in this building. But, of course, it could be seen as a bribe to Putin to get the deal through. BuzzFeed reports Cohen spoke about the idea with Putin's press secretary. While we now know Russia was interfering in the U.S. presidential election and Donald Trump was saying he had no business dealings, if this story about a penthouse offer is true, would it be violating any laws?
That is a great question for prosecutors to explore. I should make clear that our correspondents have not stood up this particular aspect of the Russia story ourselves. However, according to that BuzzFeed report you talked about, this was something that people inside the Trump Organization were discussing among themselves as kind of a sweetener or a gimmick to get the ball rolling on a Trump Tower project in Moscow, which they had been trying to get underway for several years before that time. This was in the early part of 2016. And what the president's former attorney Cohen has admitted in his guilty plea last week is that even though he told congressional investigators before that there had been a notional project, the discussions ended in January of that year. But now he admits they continued through June. And so after Trump became the GOP frontrunner, and the same month that Donald Trump Jr. and Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner and the campaign chairman Paul Manafort hosted a delegation of Russians in New York City, whom they were told were going to bring them political dirt on Hillary Clinton. Now, the participants in that conference say they didn't get what they expected and they didn't do anything with it and they didn't do anything wrong. But there are a lot of unresolved storylines here, as you've been saying. There are a lot of part of this story, the picture of the puzzle, if you will, that we can't piece together yet. Right. And if, in fact, we get this Flynn material today, that could be one more piece to put in to try to see what this picture looks like.
And just briefly, what about President Trump's tweets, one in which he called his former lawyer Michael Cohen? Again, he's cooperating with investigators. He called on him to serve a full and complete sentence. Then he quoted the consultant Roger Stone saying he'd never testify against Trump and wrote, "Nice to know some people still have guts." Is this witness tampering?
Well, that's for prosecutors and a jury to decide, at least in those strict terms. But the president's position all along has been that there is no basis for any of the investigations by Congress or the Justice Department into his prospective involvement or his campaign's involvement with the Russian attack on the election in 2016. He calls it a hoax and a witch hunt. And the position that he's taken is, given this abuse by prosecutors and the aggression of the Justice Department, it would be foolish for him to take the idea of clemency for people involved off the table because, again, in this view, they would be the subject of abuse and overreach. And so although the president has said he hasn't discussed directly the idea of a pardon or clemency with people involved, he says publicly when he's asked by reporters, when he does pool sprays at the White House, that that could still be on the table. And if that's in fact the case, that could offer some hope for Manafort and Stone and other people in the Russia affair.
Phil Ewing, thanks as always.
Thank you.
If you're listening to this, there's a good chance Queen Elizabeth II has been the Queen of England for your entire life. She's 92 and has been on the throne for 66 years. In 2015, she surpassed Queen Victoria, becoming the longest-serving British monarch in history.
Inevitably, a long life can pass by many milestones. My own is no exception.
On our recent visit to London, we stopped by Buckingham Palace to talk about the Queen with Victoria Murphy, former royal correspondent for the Daily Mirror and author of the book 60 Glorious Years. So as we look over Buckingham Palace, the first thing that we see is that the flag is up at full mast. What does that mean?
Well, the royal standard is flying at Buckingham Palace, which means that the Queen is in residence. It's the flag that flies when she is in residence in Buckingham Palace. We usually expect her to be in residence midweek at Buckingham Palace. It's her official residence. It's where she carries out things such as investitures. She holds audiences. She has offices there. It's where she does a lot of her work. It's where she spends her working week, effectively.
How much work does she do during the week?
Well, for a 92-year-old, a lot. She is still incredibly busy. Last year, she carried out almost 300 official engagements. She is slowing down a little bit, unsurprisingly.
She's passing on some duties to her son, Charles.
She is, exactly. We're seeing that at the moment. We're seeing this kind of gradual transition. For example, Charles has laid the wreath at the cenotaph to remember the war dead for the last 2 years running, and that is the nation's wreath that he is laying on behalf of the Queen, on behalf of the nation. She also no longer does any overseas travel, any long-haul travel, which is quite significant because, of course, she remains Queen in 15 Commonwealth realms outside of the UK, and she is unlikely ever to visit those countries again. But she is still busy. She still has audiences. She still receives her red boxes of government papers every single day. And she once said, "I have to be seen to be believed." And she clearly still holds that very true because she is out and about on engagements, meeting the public still regularly. She recognises that in order for the monarchy to stay relevant, in order for the monarchy to stay popular with the people, that it has to move and change with the times. So we have seen recently in the last few years the royal family really embracing social media. She has her own Facebook page. They regularly tweet. They have been very much embraced technology and allowed people to kind of get a little bit more of a glimpse, perhaps, through that of what is going on behind closed doors.
Do you think that she enjoys that, more of a glimpse? Because it seems over the years like she's tried to keep things the way that they were in many ways. She doesn't like showing a whole lot of emotion, for example.
I think that's very interesting. And I think what the royal family has to do is that they have to tread this line very carefully of being both relatable and ordinary, but also extraordinary. And part of that is maintaining some element of mystique. And the Queen has been very careful to do that over the years. Of course, as a constitutional monarch, she cannot get involved politically. She can advise and warn her ministers, but she should not be seen to be involved in political matters. And so she does need to not express an opinion. We shouldn't know her thoughts about political matters, and she has been very good at keeping anything to herself over the years. I mean, there was one period in her reign when she did allow a lot of insight. In 1969, there was a fly-on-the-wall documentary produced called The Royal Family, produced by the BBC, and they were allowed to film the royal family behind closed doors. And the film was produced and it was incredibly popular and it was incredibly eye-opening. It showed them having barbecues at Balmoral, having chats with each other. It showed them inside their palaces, having dinner, all of the things that they were saying to each other in private moments. Interestingly, I think we can conclude that actually they potentially saw that as a bit of a mistake, because they have never done it since. Mm. And that documentary is now unavailable. Certain extracts of it are available,
really?
but it's not something that I think that they regarded as a good idea. I think the Queen probably believes that there does need to be an element of mystique, I think, surrounding them in their day-to-day lives.
One of the big moments that a lot of Americans remember, and a lot of people all over the world remember, is when Princess Diana died, and that the Queen was under a microscope in terms of how she reacted to that.
Since last Sunday's dreadful news, we have seen throughout Britain and around the world an overwhelming expression of sadness at Diana's death. We have all been trying in our different ways to cope. It is not easy to express a sense of loss, since the initial shock.
What lessons do you think she learned from that experience?
I mean, the Queen has been incredibly popular throughout her whole reign, but there is one moment where it is generally concluded that she was a bit out of step with public opinion, and that is, of course, when Princess Diana died. She was at Balmoral with Prince William and Prince Harry, just lost their mother. She felt that it was her duty to protect them and to keep them out of the spotlight and keep them away from everything that was going on. But of course, it was a time of national grief. People were devastated and they wanted to see their queen. And, you know, headlines at the time, show us you care, where is our queen? People wanted to see her and to hear from her at that time. She remained resolute that she wanted to stay with her grandsons, but actually in the end that there was pressure there to change that stance and to come down to London and to make a speech, which she did, and again I think that shows her ability to bend when she realizes that it's necessary, and perhaps even though she felt she was making the right decision, actually the public felt something else, and so she came and did what they wanted her to do.
Are there people in the UK today who feel, why do we even have a monarchy?
There is a Republican movement in the UK. It's not a particularly strong movement with a lot of momentum behind it. There are people who feel that we should potentially have an elected head of state. However, polls do continually suggest that the monarchy remains very popular. Around two-thirds of people want us to have a monarchy. And I think actually a lot of that is to do with the Queen herself. I've covered the royals for several years, and one of the most common things I hear is that people might say, I don't necessarily have strong views about the monarchy, but I love the Queen. Mm. And I think those years of service that she has given to the country, I think people do really recognise and do really respect that she has put duty first, and she has continued to do that for so many years.
So, by the way, as we're talking, I'm just looking over at a kind of a parade that's coming by. What is that?
So we can see members of the Household Cavalry on horseback coming past Buckingham Palace there. They have got their red plumes coming out of their mm-hmm. helmets, and they are travelling up the Mall.
Just your standard Thursday morning parade
yeah.
down the streets,
well,
right in front of Buckingham
yeah.
Palace.
Yeah.
So if people love the Queen but have sort of mixed feelings about the monarchy in general, isn't that a problem for the monarchy, because whoever succeeds her is going to have a tough time?
I think polls do suggest that there is strong support for the monarchy as well as just for the Queen in this country. However, I think that Republicans have probably correctly identified the fact that the end of her reign will be a time to spark renewed debate. There is a lot of allegiance to her personally for the years of service that she has put in. And of course, her successor will not have the opportunity to build up that relationship over a long period of time. Prince Charles will unlikely be king for anything anywhere near as long as his mother has. I think actually what we're seeing now is a real softening towards Prince Charles. Over the last 20 and 10 years, we have seen a public opinion warm towards him and Camilla as well. I mean, if you think back to 20 years ago, not long after Diana died, you know, they were really unpopular, and that's not the case now. And actually we've seen with the coverage of his 70th birthday recently that there has been quite a strong celebratory element to it, and quite a lot of positive noise around him, which does bode very well for the monarchists and for the continuity of the monarchy.
Is it a sure thing that he will be the next king, or could they skip him and go right to William?
It's definitely a sure thing. The system that we have in this country, a constitutional monarchy, means that the moment the Queen's reign ends, the moment she dies, he will automatically become king. There's no kind of taking a step back and having a conversation. He automatically becomes king at that moment. There has been discussion about whether or not he should abdicate in favour of Prince William. There's no indication that that will happen. There's also no indication that there's a real public strength of feeling for that to happen. I mean, we've seen with Brexit in the UK that the British public is capable of making dramatic change when there is a strength of feeling, but we're not getting any sense that that is the case about the monarchy. You know, we would have to see a real movement towards lobbying our politicians to make that change for that to be the case, and there's just no noise about that at the moment.
And just as Queen Elizabeth II is the longest serving monarch, he's the longest serving heir to the throne.
Exactly. I mean, it's quite remarkable really, because he's just turned 70 and he's still has not got the job that he was born to do, and it's a time when a lot of other people are slowing down. And there is a recognition that that, of course, is unusual and potentially is challenging, because he could have another 10 years to go. We just do not know. But yes, I mean, what's interesting actually about the system that we have here is that it's kind of, it means that we are, barring a very unexpected disaster or an abdication, we are destined to have a sort of elderly head of state, really, for the foreseeable future, because the royal family live for a long time. Gone are the days of unexpected illness and people dying in battle. And so, actually, we're looking at a situation where people won't hand over until they're maybe 100, and then the next head of state will be in their 70s. And that's what we're looking at now with our system for, well, as far as we can see.
That's Victoria Murphy, former royal correspondent for the Daily Mirror and author of the book 60 Glorious Years, speaking with me outside Buckingham Palace.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
A key economic indicator is signaling that the U.S. economy is heading toward recession. The yield on a short-term Treasury bond is now more valuable than the return on a longer-term bond. Usually, it's the other way around, and this development shows that investors have concerns about the health of the economy. This inverted yield curve has predicted all 9 of the last recessions. For more, let's bring in Callum Borchers, who's senior innovation reporter at WBUR. Hi, Callum.
Hi, Jeremy.
So first of all, this is actually not the first story we've done about the yield curve in 2018. But remind us, what is it? Why do we watch it so closely?
All right, well, so in your head, go back to your math class and picture a basic line graph. We're graphing yields, which is the rate of return on investment, and time. In this case, we're talking about the time for your U.S. Treasury bond to mature. And as you said, normally the line would curve up and to the right, meaning that investors would get a higher yield for waiting longer for their bond to come to maturity. But when the line inverts, as it has, and curves down, it means it's actually a higher yield for the short-term investments. And economists watch these curves closely because, as you mentioned at the top, an inversion can be a signal that a recession is coming.
So when people think that there is a recession coming, they think there's more risk now than 10 years down the road. So they jump into longer-term bonds, which drives their price up and the yield down. And short-term bonds, which are normally seen as less risky, have to offer a higher yield to attract investors back.
That's exactly right. A higher yield is the investor's reward for assuming more risk. And typically, investors view those longer-term bonds as slightly riskier than shorter-term bonds, which makes sense if you think about it. It's harder to make predictions farther down the road. More time means there's more opportunity for something to go wrong. So a longer-term bond usually has to offer a higher yield to entice investors to take that risk. But if investors think there could be a recession right around the corner, the calculus changes and they view the longer-term bond as safer. So they start buying up those long-term bonds. That drives down the yields on those notes. And then the yields go up on the short-term bonds because they're actually now seen as the riskier investment.
So I spoke today with Peter Navarro, who's the White House economic and trade advisor, who described the U.S. economy not as waiting for a recession, but as strong and bullish. He then took a moment to say, and the Fed should not raise interest rates. What is the Fed's role in the yield curve, and what will they do with this information?
All right. Well, it is true the Fed has been steadily increasing short-term interest rates in response to the strong economic growth that we've seen. And that is one factor that's been helping the yields on these short-term bonds, catch up to or even surpass, in at least one case, the yields on the long-term bonds.
Mm-hmm. So will they be watching the yield curve and saying, oh, we better change our strategy? This is predicting a recession? Or, you know, does this yield curve actually predict the recession, or is it just coincidence that it happens at the same time as other recessions?
It is perhaps more of a predictor than a cause, but it's also not a perfect predictor. No thing is. You know, the old business axiom that past results do not guarantee future performance still holds true here. And I think it's worth remembering that there are other factors here that could be contributing to the perception that the short-term bonds are the riskier investment. We're in the midst of a trade dispute with China, for example. Yes, there is a 90-day ceasefire as of this week, but there's still some near-term uncertainty there. And so rising rates on those short-term bonds, even to the point of inverting the yield curve, doesn't necessarily mean that a recession is definitely coming.
And all of our heads have just exploded. Callum Borcher is a senior innovation reporter at WVOR. Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Former President George H.W. Bush will lie in state in the Capitol Rotunda in Washington until tomorrow morning. Then his funeral will be held at Washington National Cathedral. The following day, his body will be buried in Texas at his presidential library at Texas A&M University in College Station, his final resting place in the family plot next to his beloved wife, Barbara, and their 3-year-old daughter, Robin, who died of leukemia. Historians will debate his legacy, but individual Americans are already weighing in. Here are two students interviewed by KHOU-TV in Houston, gathered over the weekend on the campus of Texas A&M University to pay tribute.
We cannot replace him. There is no way, no chance.
He had this incredible grace and love that we need today.
Meanwhile, in Maine, two veterans at the American Legion in Kennebunkport told WCSH-TV that they remember Bush not just as a friend, but also for his service to the country.
Service before self, sacrifice, those are some of the key words that helped describe President Bush, his humility and his dedication to this nation.
I think he cared so much about the country because he was a World War veteran. He got shot down, and this was his country. He was protecting it, and he wanted to be president and protect it also.
George H.W. Bush had a lot of friends in Kennebunkport, Maine, where he and former First Lady Barbara Bush made their summer home on a piece of land that jutted out into the Atlantic, property that George Bush's mother developed more than 100 years ago. Two people in that group of friends, Helen Thorgelson and Bonnie Clement, who own HB Provisions, a general store in this small town, and had the unique privilege of a president at their wedding. Let's get the story from them. Helen, Bonnie, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yes, we are.
And Bonnie, I'm going to start with you. Tell me the sense in Kennebunkport. I mean, many of us in New England have been up there. You know, you can go out to Walker's mm-hmm. Point and look out at the house.
Right.
But tell me the sense of them in town there.
Well, we've certainly had a lot of conversations with people about this and our whole friendship with them. You know, the fact that they were just regular, down-home, family-friendly, genuine, generous people. I mean, they were a part of our town and a piece of the glue for our town that really a reason why a lot of people came into town. But they wanted to never make it about them. They wanted to make sure that the town continued to run and that it didn't. They tried to cause the least amount of disruption to it as things were happening in our town because it's a very big tourist area. We have a lot of people that come into town, and including them and their whole family.
It's one thing for them to come into the store and be good customers and lay low. But you and Helen also had the experience of George H.W. Bush in his wheelchair and his wife, Barbara, coming to your wedding and being the witnesses and signing your license?
Yeah, we got engaged. He heard about it and contacted us and said, oh, so where's my invitation? Because, you know, we want to come to your wedding. And so we said, well, okay, but we haven't put him out yet. And then he kept asking us when we'd see him. He'd be like, I haven't seen my invitation yet. You sure it's in the mail? Then he would sort of send some of his other staff, go and ask them if the invitation's out. He was sort of like, you know, as anxious about it as we are, I think. But we did give them, you know, the invitation. And they, of course, graciously wanted to come and agreed to come. But not only that, we had to ask them, not in return for coming, but just ask them because we thought it would be such an honor for us if they would sign our certificate. And they didn't even, you know, think twice about it. They said, yes, absolutely. They did it. And they did sign it immediately following the ceremony.
And you said, you know, you put on social media this picture of, look, there's a former president, George H.W. Bush, in his wheelchair.
Right.
You know, this is in 2013. That's him signing my license. And bam, I mean, it just went viral.
Yes.
And Helen, I mean, when you did that, you know, what was the spirit of it? Was it a political statement? Was it, what was it for you?
Oh, gosh. None of it was political ever. It was just the joy from our wedding and the excitement from the day and just wanting to share with my friends that, you know, that we had gotten married and had a wonderful ceremony.
Yeah. And what happened?
Shortly after I posted that picture, we got on an airplane and flew to London and spent some time sightseeing. And it was quite a while before we got back online and looking at Facebook and email and that kind of thing. And there were just all of a sudden we had realized that the whole thing had gone viral. And people were reaching out from all corners of the world trying to reach us. It was quite something. It was pretty surprising.
Well, especially since for many people, George W. Bush, the now late president's son, was against gay marriage. George H.W. Bush, a big defender of family, you know, family first, had always been his saying. And I think many in the Republican Party were surprised at his support. Were you?
No. I mean, we're just Helen and Bonnie, and we own the store, and people come in and out, and they see us, and they know us, and I think really very few people really thought about, oh, it's a gay wedding. It was the big thing, and it was really just about knowing two people that had been together for a long time and that were now getting married.
Yeah.
There was nothing political meant by it. And I think for 41, he just wanted to come and be a part of it because we were friends and community members. And so that it was really done for that reason. And as I said to Bonnie when we were talking to different news media, that if we can make a difference for one person, then it's all worth it.
So, Bonnie, did the Bushes ever speak about their being there and you having a same-sex wedding, or was it not even brought up?
No, it just really wasn't. I mean, I know the media, you know, of course, went right after them and wanted to find out if it was a political statement, and they said, you know, we went to a wedding of our friends, and because we don't make a big deal out of things. It's sort of like, you know, we're just happened to be two people that got married and it just so happens we're same sex. And it's to us, it's not, I mean, we just don't make a thing out of it.
I know, Bonnie, that you and Helen are going to the memorial service.
Correct.
And it would probably seem obvious to say goodbye to a friend.
Right. And we're first going to the Capitol and stand in line like everyone else. I mean, there's nothing about that gets us to the head of the line or any faster, but we're more than wanting to honor him. So we're going to do that. And then on Wednesday, we are going to Andrews Air Force Base to the departure ceremony for him departing back to Houston. And yes, to say goodbye. I mean, it's been kind of a whirlwind. Mm. I think it's been that for everyone and all the planners. All of a sudden, it, like anything that's, whether it's a family death or like this, it's, you know, it will be after the fact, well after, when all the dust settles, as they say, that then you'll be able to go, oh, oh, geez, you know, he's gone. He's not ever coming back to our, you know, his town, our town. And that's when the, I think this summer we'll really acknowledge it. Not having Barbara here for the first time was a big loss for everybody as well.
Yeah. And Helen, jumping off what Bonnie said, you know, going to Washington, and as everybody's debating the legacy of the man as a president and a politician, what will you be thinking?
You know, thinking about how much he taught us about decency and kindness and thinking of others first and the service part, the volunteerism. And to me, that's a huge part of who he is. And as well, just remembering his letter writing. He and Barbara both wrote letters to people all the time. And I think it's a bit of a lost art. And if we could each write a letter, one a week, this world would be a better place. And President Bush was also about relationships. I mean, that's how the Cold War ended. It was a result of relationships that he had formed. And something that he did so naturally and effortlessly, it would be a nice thing to emulate.
That's Helen Thorgelson. She and her wife, Bonnie Clement, are the owners of HB Provisions, the general store in Kennebunkport, Maine, and have the distinction of having George H.W. Bush be the witness to their marriage, signing their license. Helen, Bonnie, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Tumblr, the social sharing site, is banning all adult content from its platform starting December 17th. The announcement this week comes after Apple removed Tumblr from its App Store over the appearance of child pornography on the site. But some users feel taking the step to ban all adult content is going too far. For more, let's bring in our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ronnie Mala is data editor at Recode. Ronnie, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So Tumblr's announcement yesterday that it is banning adult content came as a surprise to some who didn't know there was porn on Tumblr, although I'm sure there are many people who did know there was porn on Tumblr. Describe this niche that Tumblr has carved out for itself when it comes to adult content.
So heretofore, Tumblr had allowed adult content. So naturally, communities sort of built up around that. This was the place you could feature adult content. Originally, people had migrated from LiveJournal when they started banning adult content to Tumblr. So this became a place where people thought that you could put it. And now that's no longer the case.
And what's behind that decision?
A few things. Tumblr was purchased by Verizon last year. That might have something to do with it. And then after this child porn incident on Apple, they really had to reconsider what they wanted on their site. The CEO had said something to the effect of they wanted a better, more positive Tumblr, a safe space for creative expression. Also that there's a lot of other platforms that do allow this content. So I guess they're just drawing that decision.
And the difficult part of this is, as it is for Facebook, as it is for Instagram and other sites, is to actually monitor everything that's out there. And they're going to be using algorithms for that. But there are already reports from users that innocent images are being flagged as explicit. How good is the technology to figure out what should be up there and what shouldn't?
It's certainly imperfect. They're trying to do this at scale for so many accounts. So naturally, a lot of stuff is going to get swept up. I saw people complaining about cartoons, a picture of a vase, all sorts of stuff getting flagged. You know, they're using pretty broad strokes when maybe they need a finer brush.
Okay. Well, and we welcome listeners who want to talk about what they think about this decision at hereandnow.org. Meanwhile, Ronnie, let me ask you about another big story in the tech world, which is Peloton surpassing SoulCycle in the number of customers that it's got. First of all, remind us or tell people who don't know, what is Peloton?
Peloton is a on-demand tech-based exercise. Basically, it's a bike you could have in your house that has a screen so you could take either live classes or pre-recorded classes in your home.
Okay. And you pay a lot of money for them. I think they're a couple thousand
bucks.
They're
very expensive. $2,000 for a Peloton plus a monthly fee of about $40.
Okay. But they have been hugely successful, and we're starting to see even brick-and-mortar stores pop up all over the place.
Yeah. I think this has to do with people wanting to like everything else, they want their exercise to be on demand. They want to be able to do it to work out on their own schedule, not on a class's schedule. So I could certainly see why that's preferable to some people.
So how big a deal is it that they have surpassed SoulCycle in the number of customers they've got?
I think it just shows a larger trend of people moving towards this, as I said, on-demand, tech-based, in-your-home thing. It also means that both of these things are prohibitively expensive, but for the price of 3 SoulCycle classes, you could actually buy and use a Peloton unlimited, and anyone in your house could use it. So it might be a matter of just pricing.
And when you look at the pricing of these companies, SoulCycle withdrew its application to become a public company this year. Peloton, recently valued at $4 billion, is set to go public next year.
Yeah. I don't know if going public or SoulCycle pulling its application to go public means that much. They had blamed market conditions. Certainly, if you stay private, you could avoid a lot of public scrutiny. But overall, you can see that as Peloton becoming, you know, growing, where the other one might be just trying to hold still.
I want to ask you about one more thing, which is as we get into the holiday season right now, one of the big gifts probably many people are going to be getting is a smart speaker. And it turns out now that 16% of Americans have one of these devices. What do you think of that? And where are they successful and where are they not?
Well, they're really successful when you're trying to call up audio content, you know, music on Spotify or radio. There's a stat in my story that about last year at this time, about 4% of NPR's live streaming came through smart speakers, and now about 20% comes through it. So this is really important. This is a really important thing for media and as a way for people to quickly call up the content they want. It also works really well for driving, for people with disabilities. But I argue that we haven't found the big major use case that, you know, the thing you couldn't do on your phone or by standing up and walking a few feet to turn on your lights or turn on the stereo. I think the real Jetsons-y type thing is in the future. The perfect use case, the thing that we couldn't have done without voice, has yet to be invented.
Well, my dog is listening to public radio right now on a smart speaker. Rani Mala, data editor at Recode, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR. Hi, Midas.
Hi, Midas.
Here Now is a production of NPR, WBUR, in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.